and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is March 28th, 2017. This is our morning meeting for the day. We will also have an afternoon meeting. This is the Senate's Committee on the Economy. So we are today having this morning meeting. We have two items on the agenda. We have some boards and commissions, and then nominees that we'll hear from, and then we will be hearing Senate Bill 98. And the time is 9 o'clock in the morning. I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Senator Hughes. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Senator Stevens. Good morning. Welcome. And I'd like to thank Carrie and Kyle, the recording secretary and LIO operator. So we will be beginning this morning's meeting with a look at several boards. And we have been considering appointments to state boards and commissions for some time now. I want to thank the nominees for your time and for serving the state of Alaska. It's very important to have Alaskans involved in government. We have over 200 boards and commissions that Alaskans serve on. And these confirmation hearings are really the only opportunity for us to interact with those Alaskans who are volunteering on these boards. And just like in previous meetings, the process will be for the appointees to introduce themselves. Then we will take members' questions. We'll take any public testimony, and then we will set the nominations aside for a later date. I'd also like to welcome Senator Gardner. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And we're going to actually take a brief at ease. Good morning, and welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. I'd like to welcome Senator Kevin Meyer. Good morning.
Good morning.
And so we will continue then with the governor's appointees to state boards and commissions. And the first board is the Board of Registration of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. This is a four-member board, I think. And our nominee that we're considering today is John Kerr. Welcome, John. If you could introduce yourself for the members and express why you're interested in serving on this board, and then we will open it up to questions.
Good morning, committee members. My name is John Kerr. I'm a land surveyor. I'm being considered for reappointment on the board. I've been serving the last 4 years in an active role. It's been very interesting. I've been a land surveyor in Alaska since the late 70s, and I appreciate the opportunity to bring my experience both working in the private sector and the public sector to support the state.
Okay. So are there any questions from committee members? We have your resume in front of us, so we're looking through that while you were introducing yourself. Are there any questions of committee members? Okay. John, I just have a question. Do you see any challenges in the future that this board is hoping to address, or challenges that you can expect that the board will be looking at?
We're considering the licensure software engineering, and that's a very broad potential topic. I've been researching it some. I know that software projects are incorporated in every engineering element these days, and so there's a life, health, safety component to it. I also know that there's huge amounts of public money wasted on unsuccessful software engineering projects. We're reading about those on a regular basis. I think that's going to be an interesting thing. I don't know that the board will or will not end up licensing software engineers, but that is definitely that could be on the agenda, and it's a big topic.
Oh, great. Thank you for that. Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kerr, for serving and for stepping up to do another round. I have a question just in your particular industry, land surveying. whether land surveyors in the state of Alaska are beginning to use drones for land surveying. I've heard that that can speed up the process, and if that has been an issue that your board has discussed.
Yes, surveyors are using drones. There are some use of drones that falls underneath the definition of land surveying and some that doesn't. We have been actively discussing the topic. Drones are a great tool for certain applications. I don't think that the use is going to be as broad in land surveying as the general hype about drones currently is, but it's not suitable for large projects. It's great for fill-in or smaller projects. You just can't cover the territory with a drone that you can with a fixed-wing airplane. So it's just a different platform for carrying measuring devices, but it sure has got a lot of attention.
Senator Hughes?
Thank you for that, Mr. Kerr, and we do have a legislative task force on that matter, so if you ever have any issues, I would welcome and open my door to that, because we want to help industry in whatever way we can for appropriate use. So just thought I'd mention that. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that offer.
Thank you very much, John, and I did want to correct myself. This is an 11-member board, and it controls the registration, revocation of applicants in the architectural, engineering, land surveying, and landscape architecture profession. So I had mentioned earlier that there are four members, but it's actually quite larger than that. So I want to correct that for the record. And thank you very much, John. Are there any members here in Juneau or online from the public who wish to testify on this nominee? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much, and we will set your nomination aside along with the rest and forward them all in one large group.
Well, very good. Thank you, committee. Appreciate it.
Next, for the same board, we have Jeff Koontz calling in from Anchorage. Welcome, Jeff. Please introduce yourself to the committee and express to us why you're interested in serving on the board.
Hi, Jeff Koontz here. I've been an architect in Alaska for, 35 years, running my own company for 32 of those years, and have followed licensure fairly closely and be part of the regulatory process for architectural licensure. And I just wanted to give back to the community, so there was an opportunity when one of my friends, Harley Hightower, retired. He contacted me and said, hey, there's an opening for this, and I know you're interested, and if you want, you should apply. And he showed me the pathway to do that, and I did so, and was appointed by Governor Parnell, and the opportunity came up to renew, and I eagerly volunteered to renew.
Well, thank you very much. Are there any questions of committee members? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Jeff, thank you very much for your service to this board and to the community. Looks like you're involved in a lot of things. But as a architect, you've designed many buildings in API and several for the Native corporations, Alaska Regional Hospital, and several others. Is there one in particular that was more challenging or that maybe you're more proud of than some of the others?
Well, they're all challenging in one form or another. Just the most current project is usually the one we're most proud of. We just completed the patient housing project for ANTHC, which is located behind the Alaska Native Medical Center Hospital. Mm-hmm. It's a 202-room facility, kind of like a Marriott, but it primarily supports folks coming in from the villages to have medical services done, like a child who has tubes put in his ear and cannot fly back the same day. There's a housing provided for them, and it's got connectivity bridges directly into the hospital. It was a pretty exciting project to do. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but if you get a chance to tour it, there's a Ronald McDonald House on the top floor, and about know, for me personally, it took me 6 years of my career to take that project to completion, which just opened up 2 months ago.
Well, Madam Chair, I am familiar with that project. I think that was one that we did a bond. The state did some sort of bond, and it's getting reimbursed with the federal match on the Medicaid or something. It was some creative financing, I know. And I was there for the groundbreaking, but I have not seen it since you finished it. So I look forward to.
Should take a look. Basically removed the state had an opportunity to get rid of providing vouchers with a bond, and so it's kind of win-win for the state in terms of the budget, and also a win-win for the Native community and their delivery of excellent health care. So pretty great project, I think. It's really fun to be involved in it.
Great. Well, thank you for your service, and thank you for offering to serve again. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Glad to do it.
Thank you very much. Are there any other community members have questions? Okay, seeing none. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online who wishes to provide public testimony on Jeff Koontz on the Board of Registration of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much, Jeff, for calling in, and I appreciate your willingness to serve.
All right, how long do you want me to stay online for?
Actually, I don't think you need to stay online anymore, so
okay.
We'll just plow through the rest of the boards that we have.
All right, thank you, everybody. Appreciate the opportunity.
Okay, next we have the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and the nomination, we're going to be considering Robert Klein for the industry seat. Welcome, Robert. I can see you're online. Thank you for making yourself available, and thank you for being willing to serve as the industry seat. And please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and express your interest in serving.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of this committee. I have been on the ABC for quite a number of years, and we consider my reappointment. As many of you know, the work of the ABC over the last 6 years, actually, has been the rewrite of Title IV, and it's coming before you this year, I hope, in SB 76. Last year, the tip of the iceberg was passed through in SB 165, minors, and on the board was constructed. But the real work is coming before you. And we're very proud of the effort. As you know, we opened up the process to stakeholders, and several hundred people have helped and contributed to this effort. It's been a wonderful coming together of what started out with some very diverse interests, and we're all behind it, all pushing this bill now. It'd be an honor to continue on the ABC and continue with not only this work, but the regular work of Alcohol and Beverage Control Board.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Are there any questions of committee members? Okay, seeing none, again, thank you so much for your willingness to serve, and I hope that I get back to the district soon. Is there anyone here in Juneau or in Anchorage that wishes to testify on this nominee? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Next, we will be considering Rex Leith of Wasilla. Oops, I'm sorry, he's traveling and unable to join us. So we will be looking at that public safety seat at a future date for this board. Next, we will be considering the Marijuana Control Board. And our first nominee is Nicholas Miller of Anchorage for the industry seat. Nick, I can see you're online if you'd like to introduce yourself to the committee and express your interest in serving.
Good morning. My name is Nick Miller. I was really interested in serving on the board, obviously, because I wanted to join the industry, and I have 20 years' experience working with assemblies and community councils and developing regulations for another industry, and I feel like I could provide good regulations that would help the industry succeed and also provide for public safety and health as well.
Thank you very much. We're looking over your application here. Are there any questions of committee members? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to get some of your thoughts on, I'm concerned about what I hear about the on-site marijuana consumption issue, and I know you've been talking about that at your board. What are your thoughts on that, and particularly in concerning the issues of secondhand smoke and impaired driving? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think the biggest concern right now is the smoking on site. But some of the applicants that we've seen who have already applied for on-site consumption have outdoor venues and things like that available to them. So they, you know, they would have a what we would call an outside patio type consumption area. I think the biggest concern for some of the smaller Southeast communities is they have these large cruise ships coming in, and they will have a lot of tourists shopping at their facilities. And I think there's a concern that if they don't have a place to consume marijuana, then the tourists will find a place to do it. And, you know, it's not going to be good for, obviously, our industry or our communities. So I think there's a need for the consumption areas. I also believe there's a need for some strict rules around them as well. The safe smoking workplace, you know, different communities have different regulations in place. And I guess if you were asking my opinion, I would like to have the local communities have a say in the consumption, whether they want it or don't want it. Not necessarily the consumption, how it's consumed. I think that should be a local community decision.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Senator Stevens here again. Would you, Madam Chair, could you comment on the driving under the influence issue as well, if we were to have these on-site consumption places?
I would like to think it's for better or worse, I would like to think that people are responsible enough not to consume marijuana and drive, just as they wouldn't consume too much alcohol and drive as well. You know, the rules, I would say, haven't changed over the past 5 years, and unfortunately they've arrested folks, and, you know, prior to cannabis being legal for consumption and driving. So I don't think the rules are going to change. Based on some of the stories I've read, and obviously, you know, you get different research from different companies and different states, but, you know, making marijuana legal has not increased the instances of people being arrested for driving under the influence of marijuana. And I would just hope that that the consumers are responsible.
Madam Chair, can I follow up?
Senator Stevens?
Just one follow-up. I understand it, and maybe I'm wrong, but Alaska would be the first state to have on-site marijuana consumption. Are you supporting that?
My current business isn't set up for on-site consumption. That's not our plan. I do support it because I'm concerned about what happens with all the tourists when they get into some of these smaller communities, what they're going to do. I can tell you, during the Better Odd, we had lots of tourists come into our retail location and purchase marijuana. And obviously, before they left the store, we reminded them that, you know, consuming in public is against the law. And I would say 80% of them asked where they could go, and I had no place to send them. So for some of the smaller communities, it may be a little overwhelming. So I do support having some place for the tourists to go so it doesn't hurt the local community or the industry itself.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony and for your service. I have a question that I sort of lost track of the technology of testing for marijuana use. Is it possible to determine whether a person has, with any specificity, is currently under the influence, has used it recently, or simply has used it at some time in their past?
There is no way to test like they do for blood alcohol levels with specificity, but, you know, today people are being arrested and due to the motor skills test that they do. So, arresting someone for driving under the influence of marijuana or some other type of drug, they've been doing for, 25 years. So they still do that today. And but the technology is not there to do like a blood test.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Nick. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online that wishes to provide public testimony on his nomination to this board? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much, Nick, for your willingness to serve.
All right, thank you for your time.
Next, we will be considering Pete Milarek. This is the public safety seat. He's the chief of police in Soldotna currently. Pete, if you could introduce yourself to the committee and express your interest in serving on the, continuing to serve on the board.
Yes, good morning, committee members. My name is Pete Milarek. I've been with the Marijuana Control Board since the inception in 2015. Currently the chair of the board, as mentioned earlier, I'm the chief of police for Soldotna. I'm eager to serve on the board, and I believe my experience being with the board since the start and my 26 plus years in law enforcement are beneficial to the board and this new industry. Looking forward to seeing, what will happen in the future and getting through all the license applications that are out there.
So thank you very much for the introduction. This is Senator Costello. My question is if you could explain to the committee the work that you did to get signatures on a petition that would put a commercial marijuana prohibition on your borough's ballot. Could you explain to us how we should approach that activity of yours, seeing that you now are chairing the board that would be instituting this industry in Alaska?
Yeah, I think you can separate that. I'm a Kenai Peninsula borough resident. So as a person, they didn't do that as a member of the Marijuana Control Board. It was something that is in regulation that local boroughs and local governments can opt out. I was one person that gathered some signatures for that. You can see by my voting record on the board that most of the licenses are approved, and applications are approved, and most of the things are approved. And I'm not, some members are more conservative than I am on votes on the board. So I don't think that affects my ability to be on the board. It's a right that's guaranteed by local governments and people, and I don't believe I should be excluded from that right just because I'm on the board.
Thank you for that. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Pete, for serving. You may have heard the questions I asked Nick. I'll ask you the same questions. There's a concern, I think, among a lot of folks about on-site marijuana consumption around the state. And concerned that we may be the first state to authorize that activity. Do you have any comments regarding that and considering the issues of secondhand smoke to the employees as well as the issue of driving under the influence after leaving on-site marijuana consumption operation? I just appreciate knowing your position on that, Pete.
All right. Yeah, thank you for that question. As far as secondhand smoke, I'm sure that there is still, as with cigarettes, I'm sure there's still residual stuff in the air. I'm sure it can affect people. That's one thing that the board we discussed as a board, and we talked about ventilation requirements and different ventilation articles or experts, so that there isn't really any way to get all that particulate matter out of the air. So I think it is a valid concern for, you know, there may be people that want to smoke in there, but there's also the workers that may not want to consume. And if, you know, they are in a consumption area and they are watching these people, and to make sure that the customers don't over-consume, then, you know, if they're affected themselves, that's one of the questions that's there. So, I mean, I think there's some unanswered things in there, and that's why, you know, the board, we had a draft, some draft language, and it was put aside, and we're going to be discussing that again. How all the secondhand smoke affects people, we really don't know, because one of the things with marijuana that's different from cigarette smoke is there's a plethora of studies on cigarette smoking and how it affects people in the secondhand smoke, but in marijuana, there aren't many studies out there, and it's kind of a fledgling industry, especially when recreational marijuana is legalized. So I guess time will tell, and there'll need to be more studies on that. As far as driving while you're under influence of marijuana, it's difficult in the fact as compared to alcohol, because in an alcohol you can do both in marijuana and alcohol, you can do field sobriety tests, which are roadside tests for balance, reciting the alphabet, different tests for the eyes. But where it's different, there's portable breath tests that officers use after they're done. That's part of the field sobriety testing. They can use that in the field. And then there's the Data Master, which actually is an official machine once you get back to the office, that you can check the person's breath, and you can tell how much alcohol is in their blood through this instrument. It's an official instrument. There isn't anything like that for marijuana. The only way you can accurately test the amount of marijuana or THC in someone's blood is through a blood test. Blood tests are not immediate, so you'd have to either get the consent to draw blood or apply for a search warrant to get the blood, and then it'd have to be sent off to be tested, so there's no immediate results as there is with alcohol. So I think people are trying to develop some roadside thing or something where we can tell the amount of THC, but it's definitely is not as a defined science as alcohol is.
Senator Stevens?
And just a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you expect then, as Chair, Pete, that this will be approved, the on-site marijuana consumption facilities?
You know, I don't know. We have our meetings next week, and we'll discuss some regulations. It's kind of gone back to the drawing board on that. So I don't know how it's going to eventually evolve, whether, you know, there's other options. It won't be approved. It's right now, it's in regulation. It's allowed that there will be on-site consumption. We just don't have regulations in place to regulate it. So if it wasn't allowed, that those regulations would have to be removed, or it could be approved a full on-site consumption where there's you know, people can smoke and in there and do whatever, or it could be limited. There could be on-site consumption where smoking wasn't allowed, but you could be a consumption area to consume edibles or something like that. So there's different variations that could happen with this regulation.
Thank you, Pete.
Thank you very much. Are there any other? Oh, Senator Hughes?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for stepping up to serve Pete and for the time that you've been on the board. Just wondering if you, as a law enforcement officer, if you are seeing or you're aware of your colleagues across the state seeing a problem with folks driving impaired and suspecting marijuana. I understand that someone driving impaired from marijuana, it's different than with alcohol, and you can usually tell. And what I was told is with the alcohol, they might be driving too fast, and with marijuana, they might be driving too slow.
Yeah, that is possible. Your motor skills are affected, so that is going to be an indicator with both alcohol and marijuana. It's going to be, it's going to be something that's not the norm. It is a little more difficult with marijuana than it is with alcohol. That's why we need a more advanced testing for that. And I think, as you see, we've really had, when marijuana was legalized, you've had the recreational marijuana out there, and so there's probably hasn't been a lot of changes because people, with Raven versus Alaska, people could still have a certain amount of marijuana and consume it in their homes. So I don't know if the consumption's gone up, but as you get these commercial marijuana places, retail marijuana shops in place, and maybe the consumption venues, that may have a difference in whether there's more people out there that are driving under the influence, just as it would be if you had a place that didn't have any bars and then you did. Or it may not, time will tell on that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Okay, seeing none, is there anyone here in Juneau or online that wishes to testify on this nominee to reappointment to the board? Okay, seeing none. Thank you very much, Pete. Appreciate your willingness to serve and your answering our questions and making yourself available this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity of being able to share with you. Have a good day.
You too. Next, we have Mark Springer, another appointee to the Marijuana Control Board, calling in from Bethel. Welcome, Mark. Please introduce yourself to the committee and explain your interest in serving on the board.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, and members of the committee. My name is Mark Springer. I'm the statutory rural member of the Marijuana Control Board, and I'm over here in the hospital in Anchorage, and my wife's doctor just walked up, and she's okay there, right? I'll stop for a minute. Yeah. I apologize, Madam Chair, and I'm scared my wife just had a little base surgery. Anyways, I've been privileged to serve on the Marijuana Control Board as a statutory rural member for the last year, appointed by Governor Walker, and once again privileged to have been nominated by him for a 3-year term. It's been an interesting year, and I expect it will continue to be an interesting few more years as we help this new industry develop, in terms of the wishes of the voters of Alaska and with the guidance of the legislature and the administration. I'm a 40-year Alaska resident. Most of that time has been spent in rural Alaska, and I'm have a considerable interest in economic development, both in rural Alaska and in the state, and I consider my participation on the board as a opportunity to help diversify our state's economy.
Great. Thank you very much. Are there any questions of committee members? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mark. You may have heard the questions I had of Nick and Pete, and I'd appreciate your response to that as well. I think I'm reflecting a lot of concern in my communities about the on-site marijuana consumption facilities and the fact that we would be the first state in the nation to allow that. Concerns about secondhand smoke on the employees that work in those facilities and also on the impaired driving that may be a result. Appreciate any thoughts you have on that on-site consumption and where you stand on that.
Certainly, Senator, I'll be pleased to. Well, let me kind of take it backwards there. Not necessarily in order backwards, but secondhand smoke, I share the concerns of the public health community and the public in general on the issue of secondhand smoke. Some will argue that the combustion products of cannabis are not as harmful as the combustion products from a cigarette. I don't know whether I would agree with that or not. Having in my younger days coughed my share, much younger days, I'll say. I'm just not necessarily sold that marijuana smoke is less harmful to the human respiratory system as tobacco smoke is. I mean, smoke is smoke. far as I'm concerned. So I share the concerns of the public health community, and workplace safety. I also respect the local authority over smoke-free workplaces where they exist. So I think we do have some technical work to do defining what sort of ventilation systems have to be in place. I had to smile when your colleagues there said, well, one of the signs of stoned driving is if you're driving really slow. I would say, Senator, that I think anybody would agree that somebody who's intoxicated on marijuana, if they're operating a motor vehicle, certainly would not necessarily be operating it as potentially aggressively as somebody who's intoxicated on alcohol. Not to say that, that's a good thing. People should not be operating a motor vehicle of any kind under any sort of intoxication. I mean, the fact is, if you get pulled over leaving the hospital and you've had day surgery and you had anesthetic, you can be charged with operating under the influence of a drug. So that remains a concern. I would tend to hope that people would be as responsible in a potentially legal consumption location as they would be responsible in an establishment that serves alcohol relative to their consumption and their operating of vehicles. As far as the ultimate licensure, when we first started writing our regulations, the input we were getting was that there are millions of tourists who come to Southeast Alaska every year, and at least 500,000 of them are wondering where they can find a place to either, quote, have their medicine, unquote, or purchase marijuana. So the industry, and I'm not casting any aspersions on their desires to take advantage of the tourism industry, the industry, says that this is a tremendous opportunity to have on-site consumption. We've gotten a little bit of public comment about it, and the main driver there is, well, if I can't smoke marijuana in my home or in my car or in front of my kids, I would like a place to go do it, and, preferably in a social setting. And there have been a lot of arguments along those lines that have been made. So you have the economic argument that it's a big opportunity, especially in Southeast, and you have the argument that was also directed in favor of some of the marijuana clubs that existed, that we need a social setting. And, the ultimate argument is that, well, if we're going to regulate marijuana like alcohol, then people should have the ability to consume it in a commercial setting. I am still kind of in a let's see what happens mode. I know there is concern in the administration that maybe Alaska should not be the first state to have on-site consumption. I know that the state of Maine, who just recently legalized marijuana, does have on-site consumption in the law that they passed. I believe that was in a referendum or an initiative, whatever they call their process there down east. So we're going to be seeing some modeling, I think, in other states. And, I don't want to, I won't use a Neil Gorsuch line, but, I would definitely like to say that I would prefer not to take an ultimate position on where my vote might go as we develop regulations, and certainly not in the final shot. But I am very cognizant of the variety of arguments for and against on-site consumption. And I do, as I said, I understand that there are some concerns that are held in the administration, and I have to respect those, I think, as much as public opinion and industry desires.
Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate the tough position you are in and your consideration of all the issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark. Any other questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none. Is there anyone here in Juneau or online that wishes to testify on this nominee? Okay. You know, certainly we had mentioned earlier in the committee, and we do talk about this when we listen to the nominees and interact with them, but certainly the Marijuana Control Board has taken on a huge task, and it's just indicative of how much effort and attention that Alaskans are putting into the boards, you know, where they serve. And I want to thank all the nominees who've come before the committee and let you know that we appreciate your willingness to serve the state of Alaska in this capacity, and want to thank you for making yourself available today. We will be forwarding the names in a group, and so we will be setting them all aside. So again, thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Next, we will be considering Senate Bill 98, and we will take a brief at ease to allow for the commissioner and director to come forward to present the bill. Welcome back to Senate Labor and Commerce, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. And next we have Senate Bill 98. I'd like to welcome Division of Insurance Director Lori Wingheyer. Welcome this morning.
Thank you.
This is Senate Bill 98's first hearing. We'll hear from the administration. We'll take members' questions. We will open it up for public testimony, and then we will be setting the bill aside. This is the insurer's use of credit history and credit scores. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Director Wingheyer. Thank you very much for walking us through the bill. And I want to point to members and also highlight to the public that we do have a document that's very helpful. It's a side-by-side from a bill that we've previously seen in the legislature, because I imagine there'll be a few questions about comparing the version that we have seen in a previous legislature. So with that, please feel free to walk us through the bill.
All right. Good morning. For the record, my name is Lori Wingheyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Before you, you have Senate Bill 98. It's being heard at the request of Governor Bill Walker. Credit scoring is a tool used by insurance companies for personal lines insurance, and I want to go on the record because there was has been some confusion that it's used for health insurance, and it is not. It is used for auto, homeowners, watercraft, RV, motorcycle, that type of insurance, but it is not used when one is purchasing health insurance. It allows an insurer to obtain a consumer's credit history, and in that they determine an insurance score. It is one factor in determining an insurance score. And an insurance score is predictive of a risk of a consumer, how many claims you may file, and the extent of those claims. Insurance companies and various organizations have found, much like when you apply for credit, that your credit history is one factor to look at to determine if you will repay an obligation, and in this instance, how many claims you would file and the extent of the claims. It comes down to, are you taking good care of the vehicles you own, of your property? Factors that would go into that to see how this would translate into what kind of risk you are for them. If your credit score improves, you may find yourself in a preferred program. If your credit score deteriorates, you may find yourself in a less tiered program, which would have a higher rate. This bill then adds, as did 127, but it's been modified some that we'll talk to, a provision for extenuating life circumstances. And that is very important because it gives a consumer who has had a death in a family, a loss of employment, military deployment, and other factors that a prudent person would recognize as an extraordinary circumstance, a right to appeal if they feel that their credit score or their insurance score has put them in a tiered program lower than what they previously had or has impacted their premium. So if it is okay with the committee, I would start with Section 1 of the bill to go through. Section 1 in SB 98 discloses that an insurer must put in writing to the consumer that they are going to use your credit history, your credit information at the time of renewal, not just at the time of a new application. One of the issues with our current statute, which does allow for the use of credit history to be used, as it is not allowed at the time of renewal. That is what's brought around this amendment to our statute to begin with, as consumers and insurers have found that our current statute allows that on a new application, an insurer or your broker may say, we can use your credit history at the time to develop an insurance score on a new application, but we cannot use it on renewal without you signing a waiver for each renewal. It's costly and it's time consuming for both the consumer and the insurance company or broker. So what we started to amend was this renewal, that it could be used, that you would be notified upon being an applicant, a new applicant to your insurance company, that this insurance score would be used upon renewal too. So we have said in this new bill, and this is one of the governor's protections in this bill, that you be notified or reminded basically that your insurance score is going to be used when your policy is renewed. And the language has been amended as such.
Excuse me, Ms. Wingheyer, we do have a question from Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's an important concept because it was always annoying to me personally, and I'm sure to others, that every year in order to get the discount, I was reminded that they want to use my credit score, but I had to sign. Mm-hmm. So do we still have to sign every year or at renewal, or just be notified?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, you would just be notified. You would no longer be required to sign the waiver to allow the insurance company to order your credit history to determine your insurance score.
Great. Thank you.
But you would receive notification that they were doing so, and then if they found that there was an issue on your credit or your insurance score, they would notify you of such, and as the bill says a bit further on, they would notify you of what options you had to dispute your credit score or your insurance score.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I guess really fundamentally, to go back to what your earlier comments about this is for auto insurance or home insurance, it's not for health insurance. I don't understand the distinction there. Why is it not for health insurance, and does this bill say that it's not for health insurance? So maybe you can help me understand why is that we've eliminated health insurance?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, health insurance has never used as an underwriting tool credit as a determination factor.
And
part of it is,
will preclude them from ever using it?
Through the chair again, yes it would. And part of it has to do with the guaranteed issue of health insurance under the Affordable Care Act as it is today, and as it would have been last week. The guaranteed issue would not have allowed us to use credit scoring.
Can you explain that guaranteed issue?
That regardless of what your health condition is or where one lives, what state, your occupation, you would have qualified for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. And through the chair again, income, credit score, none of that would have been a factor in determining if you are allowed or eligible for health care insurance.
Thank you.
And Ms. Wingheyer, my understanding is that for the consumer, if you have a good credit score, you're not able to sort of maximize that history, and so your rates could have gone down, but because you're not allowed, the company's not allowed to look at your credit rating based on, you know, renewal, you essentially are a person who is, from their point of view, is absent a history of paying your bills on time or what have you. So the question then, I think this is the rub in the bill, is that it's the issue that we hear most about. For those folks who have a good credit rating, they are not able to take advantage of that, and so they end up, their insurance rates are going up, whereas for those folks who for a variety of reasons, don't have a good credit score, they're actually, they have more to gain based on the bill that is currently written. So do you have any information on sort of in general population-wise, do most folks have good credit rating compared to those who don't have good credit rating?
Madam Chairman, yes, and there are statistics that I believe we have some online to testify to, but the majority of Alaskans do have good credit and do have an advantage to get a preferred rate or a preferred program in personal lines insurance. And we have had more instances of people calling our office and saying they don't understand why their insurance went up 25-30%, and sometimes it's because they received the form for the waiver, they were traveling, they didn't understand the seriousness of signing the waiver to allow their company or their broker to order their credit history for renewal, and since it wasn't done, they just got an increase in their premium. And a lot of times it's one of those that it just goes to escrow because it's your homeowners and you didn't realize it until you get the escrow notice from your bank. We've had numerous calls to our office not understanding how this happened, and it's simply because of that waiver provision that it's kind of a oddity in our law that you can use it on new business, but you cannot use it on renewal. And it's truly an inconvenience for both consumers and the insurance companies.
Senator Hughes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's good news that the majority of Alaskans have good credit rating. Does that cross socioeconomic lines?
Through the Chair, Senator Hughes, there is no data to support that this has an impact on those that, on income, gender, nationality, race. We cannot find any data to support that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do recall, as we, I think everybody knows, we had this bill before, and that was really interesting to learn. So we can actually, this would be beneficial to low-income people in our state as well as people of middle and high income, from what I recall. Thank you.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. So if there's no data, does that mean that studies have been done and don't show that it impacts different population groups differently? Or is it just that the studies have been, there have been studies done and the results are not conclusive?
Through the Chair, Senator Gardner, the studies have, that have been done, including, let me look at my notes here to make sure I quote the correct agency, because I believe it was the Federal Trade Commission that did a study that showed that there, the study has been completed, and it did show that there was no impact or little to no impact on low-income constituents or consumers, that you could still be low-income and have a good insurance score or a good credit score. We also, when this bill was being drafted, we looked at rural Alaska versus urban Alaska. We looked at various demographics to see if it did make a difference for consumer protections as this bill was being drafted. And we, and based on what we received from insurance companies to see, we could not find where it would be a benefit for us to exclude rural Alaska or lower income under 26. It did not, the data did not support doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and please continue walking us through the bill.
Thank you. Section 2, which is new to this bill, we amended the notice of an adverse action, and in this we ask that a reasonable, that the notice that is required to an adverse action is taken to provide, informing the consumer that the reasonable exceptions that are taken regarding the classifications, the company, or the tier placements, how the company may request an exception for the insurer if they disagree when an adverse action is taken, and that the request for an exemption must be considered by the insurer within 60 days. It also is now states that the adverse action be given to the consumer or the policyholder in writing. This is a consumer protection that was inserted at the request of the governor that was not in 127, which was the prior bill. Section 3 clarifies that the use of a credit score may not be the only reason that an a policy may be canceled, denied, or non-renewed. And in this section, we added non-renew, underwrite, or rate personal insurance, only it has to be a combination of other underwriting factors. In this, we also amended the section, we also amended that the credit history to determine the insurance score had to be at least within 24 months. This is to allow people to improve their credit score or their credit history to improve their insurance score so that a bad insurance score or a less than perfect or a less than good, however one wants to say it, that they can improve their score and perhaps lower their insurance premium as they improve their credit history and their insurance score. Section 4 repeals the need for the waiver upon renewal. Section 5 states that the insurance companies are going to use a credit history, that it be used within the... I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, Ms. Wing-Hire. Senator Hughes has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually am looking at the sectional analysis as you're going through. And Section 4... one of the lines out of the analysis says, this section also establishes that an insurer may not use credit history to cancel, deny, non-renew, underwrite, or rate a personal insurance if the history is obtained more than 90 days before the policy is canceled, denied, renewed, underwritten, or rated. So that just says that they cannot use credit history to deny, whereas in Section 3, it could be used as a factor to deny. So are those in conflict?
In Section 3, we're amending to allow a consumer's credit history or insurance score. We're inserting the word non-renew because that was not in there before. They could cancel, deny, or underwrite, but in theory, they could non-renew based on a credit score. So we're inserting in that, and then we're adding that it has to be, they have to use it within every 24 months. It can't be more than 24 months old in that. But then we do go on to say, the insurer shall re-underwrite and re-rate the policy based on the consumer's current credit history or insurance score, risk characteristics, but not including in whole or in part the current credit history and insurance score for the refusal to offer, going on and on. But anyway, that Section 3 is having to do with the use of how old the credit score can be, how often they have to use it, that they cannot use basically an old credit score. They can't order your credit history and continue to use it for a period of 10 years, that they have to order it every 24 months.
Senator Hughes?
Yeah, and I do see that time factor, but in Section 3, you may use the credit history as one factor, but not as the only factor, in determining whether to deny or non-renew. But then in Section 4, it establishes that insurer may not use credit history to cancel, deny, non-renew.
Correct.
Within the time, related to the time frame. And it just seems like that might be somewhat in conflict. One says you can use it, one says you can't use it.
Take a brief at ease. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy, and we are just looking through Section 3 and 4. And with that, Please feel free to continue.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Hughes, looking at the statute and looking at the bill, in reading D of 2136-460, it begins with, we did insert the word non-renew to clarify that, but then what we did further back in D was to add 4, to not allow to use credit score to cancel, deny. Again, we put in the caveats of when they can use it, cancel, deny, non-renew, underwrite, or rate a personal auto insurance. More, you can't have an older than 90-day credit history. So you have to use it every 24 months, but within that 24 months, it can't be more than 90 days old. And that's the intent of the section.
Okay, thank you.
Section 5, this is the heart of putting in the extraordinary life circumstances or the consumer protections. If someone were to have obtained an adverse action and they were to look at it and say, but why did my insurance rates go up? Or why was I placed in a less than preferred program? And they went through and they said, I had a catastrophe as declared by the director under 2106, or a serious illness or injury, the death of a spouse, a divorce, identity theft, loss of employment, military, or loss of employment, an overseas deployment. And then this bill, which took the number 8 further than the original, or 127, because in 127 it said other events as determined by the insurer. We took it in this bill to say other extraordinary life circumstances where a prudent person would consider an exception to the insurer's rates, rating classifications, company, or tier placement. We thought that gave it a broader definition than letting the insurance company decide if it was an extraordinary life circumstance to give a consumer, put them back in a preferred program. This also, this section now says that the appeal process, instead of letting the insurer be the final make the final determination, if the consumer had an adverse action, if it was an extraordinary life circumstance, it now goes to the director of the Division of Insurance to say yay or nay, that the consumer should go back to a preferred program, that it was an extraordinary life circumstance or not. And that is basically the essence of the consumer protections that were put into the bill that Governor Walker feels strongly about that we're lacking in 127.
Thank you for that. So, we have some individuals who've been waiting online to testify, and I'm sure we'll hear more about this section. My question is about identity theft. So oftentimes an individual who's had their identity stolen, you don't often find the perpetrator. So what is the level of proof that the consumer would show that they've had their identity stolen?
If the first step in this is they would take it to the insurance company. They would have to show reasonable documentation through the chair, or Madam Chairman. It's not defined exactly what they'd have to show, but the statute does say that they have to show reasonable documentation that their identity was stolen. So if they can show from LifeLock, if they can show from the bank or the credit card institution, a police report, whatever it is that their identity has been stolen, that would suffice to meet the statute.
And you mentioned that their first line of recourse would be to the insurance company. So are you saying that elevating it to the state would be in those cases where the consumer doesn't agree with the decision made by the insurance company, or in all cases it's the division that you apparently that would be overlooking this?
The first would be to go to the insurance company and say, I noticed my rates went up, my insurance score has been impacted, I've received a notice of an adverse action, I'd like to dispute this, explain why under the extraordinary circumstances that it's identity theft, divorce, whatever one of these it is, and the insurance company either agrees or doesn't. If they still feel that
they qualify for an extraordinary life circumstance, then they bring it to the division. And the division then rules that, yes, it is or isn't.
And so the division then would just point to statute and tell the insurance company, you under state law have to behave in this manner? And
yes.
And what does the bill say in terms of that period of dispute? Does the consumer retain their original situation, or is the insurance company able to affect their insurance rates while this is being, and just what's that relationship like?
Madam Chairman, the consumer has to make their reasoning for the adverse action within 30 days. Then the insurance company responds, and then the director, when it's appealed to the director has to make a decision within 30 days upon receiving the appeal. Now, during that time, they're going to be in that, let's say, substandard program or that higher risk program or the one with the higher rates. But upon the decision being made, then they would be put back into whatever program they should be eligible for.
Okay, thank you. Senator Stevens, did you have a question?
Yes, just very briefly. How long is consideration given to an extraordinary life circumstances? Would it happen every year? I mean, would you, does it happen forever? You know?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I don't know that we've put in that they could make, that they could not make an appeal more than once, let's say. That if, obviously we would want them to try and improve their circumstances, but there, I do not believe that there is anything in the bill that prevents them from reapproaching the adverse action more than once or for a period of time.
And would that be then reevaluated annually by the insurance company?
Yes.
Okay, I see some of these are really more extraordinary than others.
Mm-hmm. Senator Hughes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as follow-up to the chair's comment about what that period of time where the rates might be up and they'd be higher risk, if they were found if you were determined in the appeal process that they were eligible, and a prudent person would determine that that should be an exception, would they be refunded that difference in that higher rate for that couple-month period?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes, they would.
Senator Hughes?
And then I have another question. I'm just wondering how rare or frequent this appeal process might be elevated to you if other states have done this, because I notice you have a zero fiscal note, and it is creating more work for you. I'm assuming you think it would be a rather rare instance. You wouldn't be doing this, dealing with these appeals frequently?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, we do not think that we will have many. We do think we will have some. We think that the way the bill is written, that the insurance companies, because knowing that it will go through them to come to us, that they're going to resolve them at the insurer level, and that it's going to have to be pretty egregious to come to us for them not to see that it fits the concept of the bill, that it's an extraordinary life circumstance, and solve it at their level, that they will not want it to come before the director for an appeal.
Thank you.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I have questions on two areas. One, you've mentioned notice of adverse action, and I think I understand that if somebody appeals and is denied, that's when they get a notice of adverse action. My question is, if I'm a consumer and my insurance rates go up, I don't necessarily think it's because of a credit history. I might think, oh, insurance rates are going up, they're always going up kind of thing. So do I get a notice of adverse action if my rates are going up because of something in the credit history?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that's one of the things this bill does, is when you're coming up for renewal, mm-hmm. you have signed that your insurance company can order your credit score or your credit history to determine your insurance score every time your policy comes up for renewal. January 1st, 2019, they find something on your credit history that's going to cause your insurance score to go up. And then your policy premium. You will get your adverse action at that time. So you will know it's not just because the insurance rate went up or the insurance premium, but there's an adverse action allowing you time to call the insurer or your broker to say what adverse action, order your credit history to start determining what happened. And if it is an extraordinary life circumstance, to start the process at that time, if that's what needs to be done.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. So two questions come to that. First of all, what if there's something wrong in your credit history? Is that something, and it takes a while to clear that up. And so then you get this notice of adverse action. You learn that it's based on your credit score. You go back and you get your credit score and look at it and dispute something. That can be a long process.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I would take that as the first part of the extenuating life circumstances, which is not a catastrophe, but there is the last one, as other extraordinary like circumstances where a prudent person would consider an exception.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that having a mistake somebody made on your credit score isn't necessarily an extraordinary life circumstance. It's just a mistake somewhere. My life hasn't had a weird turn, but so something to think about. And Madam Chair, if I might, we had a question about how much you can appeal, and I thought you said you cannot appeal more than once, but then maybe I misunderstood. I'd like clarification. And then in terms of how often, if you're a person who pays monthly or quarterly rather than annually, your rates can only be adjusted once a year. Is that what you said?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, your payment to the insurance company is not impacted by this bill. You may have a policy that renews every 6 months, your auto. It may renew annually. Depending on when it renews is when they may order your credit history. Most policies anymore renew annually.
Okay.
Did that answer?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
And I actually have a question. So these events, there's a propensity that you could assume to happen, like per 100,000 individuals, and that data is probably out there. I mean, there's probably a probability associated with identity theft and things like that, and even a catastrophe. And those events are built into the paradigm that the business model then, you know, lays out, and they plan for that. So my question is, and we have individuals online who are listening too, so maybe when they testify, they can answer this question. But if this list were to be passed, could you assume then that for the general population, all of our rates will go up because they would have to plan for a new business model that would involve the uncertainty of the you know, this type of situation and how often it happens and how often that goes to the state division, you know, of insurance for adjudication? I mean, have you have any comments on that?
Senator Costello, no, I think actually if this bill goes into effect, we will see probably rates stabilize, if not decrease a little. Different insurers have told us that they, because they cannot use credit scoring, or I should say they opt not to use credit scoring in the state of Alaska because of the having to get it at renewal or through the waiver, or because they just choose not to use it at all because of you can only get it on new business but not on renewal business, so they don't use it at all. And they feel if they can use it throughout the course of a policy or a policyholder's business relationship with them, that rates would decrease in the state of Alaska. And I know from talking to consumers and seeing the rate increases they have taken because they have not completed the waiver, or insurance companies have not sent them the waivers simply because of the administrative burden put on the insurance companies, I think we will see that it is a more of a positive impact to rates in the state of Alaska than a negative impact, even with the appeal process put in.
Okay, thank you for that. So that does address another section of the bill, which is why I think you saw that it received such positive reaction in the previous legislature. But my question was specific to this section. Could you explain further that, you know, obviously when you can use, you're saying most Alaskans have a positive credit score, so this, the other section of the bill will allow for that information to be used to their benefit, mm-hmm. for the most part. And there will be exceptions to that, and I'm sure we'll hear concerns that will be brought up at that time. But my question really is about this section. I mean, even if they go down somewhat, I mean, would they not go down as much because you have to, you know, accommodate your policies for these types of uncertainties? Because currently, right now, the insurance companies deal with this in the manner that they do, and we're changing that so that they would have to come to the state in some cases.
In some cases, that's Senator Castell, that is absolutely correct. But this, we are not the only state to put in extenuating life circumstances. This is coming out of an NCOIL model. We have modified the last provision for the prudent person, but they are doing this for extenuating life circumstances in other bills or other states. So their processes already includes this for an appeals provision. So I don't think that we're going to see much of a factor as far as an increase for doing this in the state of Alaska.
Okay, thank you for that. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the explanation. I guess I am as well concerned that the additional administrative burden we're putting on the insurance companies that, A, they may not even use the credit scores, or B, the consumer may not see the discount that we would have under the previous bill that we passed last year. But is it fair to say that this Section 5 is important to the governor, and that may be one of the reasons why he vetoed the bill last year?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, SB 127 contained this provision. What is different in Section 5 this year is the prudent person, and that the final decision maker on if the appeal is valid or not is the director of the Division of Insurance. That's pretty much the only two changes in Section 5. But SB 127 contained this language.
So, Madam Chair, why was the bill vetoed last year?
The adverse action notices, and primarily because the governor was very concerned that if you were making an appeal, the person who had basically given you notice that your insurance score had gone up was also going to be the final one to tell you that your insurance score had gone up under an appeal.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Meyer, for that question. And I have a question, too, before we get to Senator Hughes. So is the division the best place to send that recourse action to, or is there a board or some other? I mean, how much thought went into who that should be? Because apparently that's you, mm-hmm. And you alone. And I'm just curious, was there any discussion about, oh, is there an existing board or something that would make more sense for this to go in front of?
Senator Castell, we did look at other means. We look at things like the OAH. We looked mm-hmm. at other, where else we could take it. And the division already has mechanisms for consumer complaints and work comp classifications, where we do, quite honestly, I assign someone in the division to conduct a hearing, gather the data, look it over, and make a determination. So we already have the means or the processes set up within the division. And after looking at how would we handle this, we made the determination that it would be more time effective and more cost effective to handle it within the division with our own processes that have been there for a number of years and worked quite well.
Thank you. And one follow-up. So the NCOIL, which is the National Council, you said this is model language. Is this Section 5 really actually identical to the model language, or are there any things that were added or perhaps removed in the section that we now have before us?
Madam Chair, it's a lot of it is word for word. Again, we put in the prudent person, and then the piece where the adverse action has to be, they have to notify on the adverse action, and that the director shall give be the final decision maker if an appeal is given.
And other states, who determines that the final decision?
I believe that still lays with the insurer.
Okay, thank you for that. Senator
I would
Hughes?
Have to go back and check, but I believe it still lays with the insurer.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hughes?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. This is follow-up to Senator Meyer's question about the reason for the veto, and I can appreciate the communication and the notice as far as adverse action. But you also mentioned that one of the things that the administration did was to look at the demographics in Alaska. You've mentioned the rural areas to see if they would be impacted. Was also part of the veto was concern that it might impact certain populations, low-income populations, and that was part of the reason of the veto?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that was looked at last year as well. We did not specifically look at it this year, but we did look at it last year when the bill was up, as SB 127, when it was Senator Huggins' bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. If you could continue, unless there are other questions. Okay, seeing none.
Senators, Section 6, when we were talking about, did we look at where this would, the appeals would best be handled, we specifically just put in Section 6 that this would not go before an administrative hearing. And so we're just adding this section to clarify that this would not go to an administrative hearing. And that is the last section of the bill.
Okay. Are there any questions of committee members? Seeing none, thank you very much for the thorough review. And we will take public testimony on this bill. I see there have been a number of people online since 9 o'clock this morning, so I'll just go down the list. We'll open public testimony. Cinda Smith with GEICO, please feel free to introduce yourself to the committee and provide your testimony.
Morning. Good afternoon from the East Coast. Good morning to you all. Thank you for hearing this bill. The director has very eloquently stated the pluses and minuses of the bill. And GEICO is fully in support of the measure, and we simply want to add a me too that this bill is good for consumers. It has the adequate consumer protections that the director has laid out, and we ask for your consideration and approval vote on the bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of committee members? Okay, seeing none. Next, I'd like to invite Christy Babcock, calling in from Kenai. She's with State Farm. Good morning, Christy. Please feel free to share with the committee your public testimony on the bill.
Thank you, Senator Costello and members of the committee. My name is Christy Babcock, and I am an independent contractor, State Farm agent in Kenai. And I had about a 4 or 5 minute testimony prepared. However, the director has done such an excellent job of explaining this bill that I am going to not do most of it. The problem is that is in current law is still impacting my customers. You may recall there was a similar bill last year that passed the legislature that was vetoed. And so the problems that you all know about and that the director has explained are still there. And what I hear from customers is this. They still are saying, can't you please just charge me the rate I deserve? I was happy when I came to you. I shopped around. Do I still really have to keep coming in every year on every policy and sign this? So we explain it to them. And there still are customers that we miss, and that is the really sad part, is that they, you know, they miss it because they're busy or they're working, and then they end up paying more. And these are customers of all demographics that are working super hard to keep their credit strong, their driving record good, you know, all the good things that would make them the risk that they are. As you know, Alaska is the only state that makes companies strip out the credit upon the policy's renewal. It just creates a very volatile situation for our customers. I still employ one person. He deals exclusively with our process of contacting consumers when their policy is going to renew so that we can try to continue to give them the best rate that they deserve. In conclusion, the impact of SB 98 would be a positive one. I'm completely in support. The situation we've got now with these dramatic swings feels to our customers a little bit like bait and switch, and this law would correct that. Secondly, it would eliminate the frustration and cumbersome process of getting a manual waiver signed at each renewal, every year, every car, every policy. And it would also just allow consumers to shop with confidence, knowing that there's stability in the rating factors, stability between the factors initially and the factors that happen at renewal. I am. Thank you again for hearing this bill, the opportunity to speak, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Hughes has a question, Christy.
Hello, Christy. Good to hear your voice. I'm just curious, there are differences between this bill this year compared to last year, and it sounds like you're supportive of the changes as well. Can I assume that?
Yes, Senator Hughes and members of the committee, I am supportive. The major change is just that the final word on whether an exception should be given now rests with the director as opposed to with the insurance company. Certainly something that makes sense and don't have a problem with.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christy. As Senator Gardner?
Thank you. Christy, if a consumer doesn't notice when the rates go up and isn't paying attention and then, say, 2 months later realizes it and calls to inquire why, is it too late to change the rates going forward, or is there a window that is locked in?
Senator Gardner, are you asking about the way it is under current law or the way it would be under this bill?
Let's say both.
Okay, well, so under the current law, we are not allowed to use their credit unless we get their written authorization. That's the way the current law is. And so what happens currently is, 45 days before the policy is going to renew, we get notice of, that it's going to renew and what the rate's going to be. And so we have a process to see, oh boy, these rates are going up. At the same time, the customer's getting their bill. You're right. They may or may not notice that their rate's gone up, but we notice. And so we want to catch it while we still can. And under current law, we have to get their authorization before their renewal date in order to use their credit for that renewal. So if the policy renews without getting their authorization to re-rate that policy, we can't use their credit characteristics after the renewal and still be in compliance with current law. Now, under the provisions of this bill, it's going to allow an insurance company to, at each renewal, use all of the characteristics of that customer to correctly classify what kind of risk they present. And so I believe, maybe the director can speak more specifically, but I believe that if they want to appeal regarding one of the extenuating life circumstances, I believe there's a 30-day provision as far as the ELC appeal.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. So currently, if I don't notice my rates have gone up and 2 months later I wake up and call and say, why did this go up? And you say, well, we didn't hear back from you. We notified you your rates were going up and asked for approval to use your credit history or whatever. And you say to me, I can't do anything, so why would I not just cancel my policy and start over again?
Senator Gardner, it's an excellent question, and that's one we deal with a lot, because there are some people that for whatever reason, either we missed them or they didn't see the mail, and so the policy renews. They certainly could start over, and some companies, that's what's happening a lot, is they're calling a different company then and starting over. And so you end up with this churning, and so they don't get the benefit of maybe having a long-term relationship or having some stability of being with a continuous policy for many years, because they do. They wake up, they see that their rate changed at renewal, and so we can't just say, oh, because you asked us 2 months later, we're going to use the credit for your renewal. Because state law doesn't let us. So that's the problem. What you've said is exactly what the problem is. Now, yes, the solution could be, well, I just won't respond to the bills I'm getting every year and the changes there are. Instead, if it goes up, I'll just go shopping. But in the midst of that situation, that's where the customer frustration is. Because the customer says, are you telling me that really, in order to have all of my characteristics used, I have to start a new policy? What kind of business model is that? And we explain, well, it's not really a business model. It's the way it is under state law right now.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. So you're saying that if that happened today and I get a renewal and I didn't pay attention and 2 months later I say to you, gee, I want you to use my credit history, let's cancel this policy and open a new policy with State Farm, can you do that? Same company?
It's not a new policy if it's the same car and the same person. So that's the way we would view that. You can call something anything you want, but if it's not a new person and not a new car and not a new, you know, we don't cancel policies. It's not a new policy. And you know, if you're already an existing customer, we don't write a brand new policy because it's not a new policy. It's an existing policy, existing car, existing person. So that's our business practice. I would actually probably defer to Sheldon Winters, who's our attorney there, or maybe one of our actuaries we have online. That's the business practice because that seems to be what state law is telling me to do. And I can't really underwrite for somebody as a new customer if they're an existing customer.
Thank you. So I don't know that it really is state law. It's State insurance company policy, but we can look into that in another time. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Next we have Armand Feliciano with the Property Casualty Insurers calling in from Sacramento. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Armand Feliciano, and I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, and also part of an insurance coalition supporting this bill. This coalition includes Alaska USA, American Insurance Association, the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies. In the coalition's collective view, SB 98 is a reasonable middle ground that would allow consumers to see the full benefits of credit scoring and put in place an equitable process to resolve credit disputes. This bill will address the unnecessary market disruption inherent with the existing statute. It also authorizes the Division of Insurance to resolve credit disputes. We believe it's a common-sense approach in fixing Alaska's existing credit scoring rules. We appreciate the opportunity to be heard, and thank you for considering our comments.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Thank you very much. Next, we have Brian Duffy. I know you're online just for questions. You're the Admin Services Director for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And my question, Brian, to you is I assume you're listening in because of the extraordinary life circumstances list, and I was wondering if you could comment on that Section 5 of the bill.
Madam Chair, for the record, Brian Duffy, Admin Services Director, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, up in Anchorage. Ma'am, no particular testimony intended. We believe the inclusion of the military overseas deployment provision is both a benefit for the member as well as the system at large. Over.
Thank you very much. Any questions of committee members? From committee members? All right. Thank you very much for calling in and listening. Is there anyone here in Juneau that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 98? Okay. Is there anyone online who wishes to testify? Okay. Seeing none, public testimony is closed on Senate Bill 98. We will be setting this bill aside. Our next meeting, committee members, is at 1:30 this afternoon. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Madam Chair, before we close, would it be all right to speak with Lori and ask her to just confirm whether or not it's state policy or company policy that doesn't permit them to include credit scores after a certain timeline?
Certainly.
Thank you.
If you could state your name again for the record, please.
Certainly. This is Lori Wing-Heyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. It's a conundrum, your question, because the Division has been very respectful of the statute, But we have had certain instances where we have felt that insurers or brokers have tried to circumvent the law by doing cancellations and rewrites and have not looked kindly if they did not get the waiver in the file. We've had some where they tried to get an evergreen waiver. So we have tried our best to be respectful of consumers who have not been happy with the statute as it's written, but also to say there's a process to get the waiver, and we need to respect the process as it's written in statute, which doesn't necessarily allow for canceling a policy on it after it's renewed and rewriting it as new business. But yet we understand where the brokers, such as Christy testified, are saying, but then that means that they can be new business to Allstate or they can be new business to Safeco. And it's hard to say, but the statute says new business only, not cancellation rewrite. And there was an opportunity to get the waiver. It's one of the issues with the current statute.
Thank you.
And a follow-up, so the opportunity to get the waiver has a deadline, and if you miss that and it's not met, and Senator Gardner's question was, even though the consumer is asking the insurance company to look at the credit score, once you've passed that deadline, there is no provision. State law is absent as to whether or not the insurance company can do that, and so we're interpreting that as you're not able to.
Correct.
Thank you. So any further questions? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. The committee is adjourned.